You're listening to On the Contrary by IDR, a show featuring unlikely conversations on topics that affect our future. Hear differing perspectives from leaders and experts as they help us make sense of the most pressing issues of our time. Here's your host, Saloni Meghani. Indian women have been dropping out of the workforce for years. For three decades since liberalization, the female labor force participation rate, or FLFPR, has been dipping from about 30% in 1990 to about 17% by 2018. There was, however, a hope-filled uptick recently when the government released the results of its periodic labor force survey. The Periodic Labour Force Survey, or PLFS, is an annual exercise started in 2017. According to this data, our FLFPR recently rose to 37%. That sounds like good news, but is it really? Our three guests this week have studied the issue closely. They help us unpack the data and look at the real story of Indian women and paid work. First, we turn to Namita Bhandare. Namita is a journalist who has written about gender issues for a long time. She started looking at women's participation in economic activity as early as 2017. Her series on Women at Work with India Spend won a national award. She walks us through what the recent data tells us and what it hides.
So I have seen now in a post-COVID world, the data varies from anything from 9%, which is CMIE, which is a very respected think tank that does publish regular data on female labor force participation. And so it's 9% to 35%, which is the latest PLFS, which is the Periodic Labor Force Survey. Regardless of who you choose to believe, I think the important thing is looking at the trend, looking at where we're going. And the fact is that actually labor force participation, I accept the PLFS data because I have no reason to dispute it. I accept it that female labor force participation is actually at its highest ever in the last 5 years. But when you pass the PLFS data and you say, well, where are these women seeking employment? Where are they employed? So the big bumps are number one, rural India, and number two, self-employed, and what they call own account, right? So which means that if I am sitting at home and I am rolling agarbattis and, you know, stuffing them into packages and earning 100 rupees a day for this labor, I am regarded as employed. If I'm rolling papars in my house, I am regarded as employed. So what has actually happened in a post-COVID world is that economic distress, the unemployment, has led to women coming back into the workforce at any salary and doing any kind of work to supplement the household income. That is the bigger story than the data.
Namita refers to the economic think tank CMIE, or the Center for Monitoring Indian Economy. For 2022 and 23, CMIE pegged female labor force participation at less than 10%. For more on how to read the data, we speak with Shrayana Bhattacharya. She is an economist and the author of Desperately Seeking Shah Rukh Khan. Her book tracks the economic journeys of women from different regions, age groups, and classes. Shrayana tells us how she interprets the dips and hikes in the FLFPR.
Since the pandemic in particular, the past 4 or 5 years, we're seeing this increase, largely driven by rural areas. I think that's very important. The urban difference actually has stayed fairly similar. There's no big increase there. And if you start to slice the rural data and look into it very carefully, you realize actually the increase is largely because of self-employment. And in fact, it's unpaid family workers, which one would argue is not really a very substantive, meaningful, qualitative shift, right, in jobs.
Both Shrayana and Namita point out that the FLFPR has gone up because rural women are resorting to self-employment in times of economic distress. Our third guest, Sharon Bhutto, has worked closely with many women entrepreneurs. Sharon is associated with iWage, or What Works to Advance Gender Equality. Based on her research and experience, Sharon sheds light on the landscape for women entrepreneurs in India.
So India is a country of, you know, nano entrepreneurs by and large, sort of historically. Women in particular, though, they're all coalesced into this very small category, 3 lakhs and below of turnover. And I would say very tiny ones. If you start distributing men compared to women, and you say, okay, this is the spectrum of up to 10 lakhs for both men and women, you see men tend to be less than 1 lakh. And then they're more and more up to 10 lakhs. Women, it's opposite. They're a lot in the less than 1 lakh category. And they're tend to be less and less in the higher categories. A, women are stuck in that small category. When you look at the data as well, you see women for most of the enterprises, women are as productive in terms of profit as men. Women tend to get about half of the loans, the credit that they do.
So while more women are starting their own enterprises to climb out of financial holes, women entrepreneurs are unable to grow adequately. Not much to celebrate there. Here's a tidbit. On October 9, 2023, the day the government gave us the FLFPR, many feminists were celebrating, for other reasons. They were happy to hear that the Nobel Prize for Economics was given to Claudia Golden, the first woman economist to win the prize solo. Namita, Shrayana, and Sharon were among those overjoyed to hear the news. Because Golden's work focuses on exactly the issues we are discussing today, employment and pay for women. Her U-shaped curve function states that women's labor force participation does not grow proportionally when the per capita GDP first starts increasing. With economic growth, FLFPR declines initially. After the initial dip, when per capita income continues to increase, FLFPR also increases, generating the U-shaped graph. Here we have Namrata reading India's FLFPR data in the context of Golden's work.
Claudia Goldwyn, who won the Nobel Prize this year, spent her entire career documenting how and why women drop out of the workforce. In India, of course, we did not have the U curve that she talks about, which is in most developed economies, women will drop out. You know, factory work leads to women dropping out of the labor force. But then as the services industry picks up, women rejoin. Now, in India, we've only seen a downward decline. We have not seen an upward trend until now, which is, as I said, the self-employed, own account, very low paid work that women are accepting out of desperation. You know, so I would not see this necessarily as good news. I don't think we can celebrate the numbers going up because the numbers are going up for very dire reasons. And once household incomes bounce back or the economy bounces back, as the government says it will, then I would anticipate these women dropping out for the same reasons that they had dropped out in the first place, because on the ground, nothing has changed.
Shrayana agrees that on the ground, it's more of the same and it's discouraging.
To use the phrase that our recent Nobel Prize winner in economics, Claudia Golden, uses, she says the revolution happens when jobs become careers, right? She says that the biggest thing that shifted in America was not actually the period when the labor force participation rates of married women in particular increased, but she felt that the biggest qualitative shift, which was the revolution, which is difficult actually for data to pick up, is when women started seeing their professional identities as being very central to who they were. And then that guided their decisions on marriage markets, on reproductive rights. So many aspects of just American society were changed with that change in attitude. And I think if you look at that particular appetite of young women in particular who are interested in careers, my sense is that actually that interest level is very high in India. And I think that's probably why we have an extremely frustrated female workforce as well, because their talents are not being adequately engaged. So I'd read the numbers as still alarming because the gap is just not acceptable by any standards of dignity or any standards of opportunities, no matter which way the graph is going up or going down. The gap is just too large.
By some estimates, Indian women are 48% of the population, but contribute to only 18% of the GDP. Bridging this gender gap could raise India's GDP by a whopping 30%. So if women are faring well in education, what is keeping them away from paid work or making them drop out of it? Namita weighs in.
So before COVID, there were two cohorts that were dropping out of the labor force faster than the others. Number one were complete illiterates. And the good news is that they were dropping out of work to a very large extent because many of them were staying on in school. Many of them were actually studying thanks to a lot of excellent NGO work such as Pratham, thanks to the midday meal, thanks to the cycle scheme, which was a fantastic game changer for girls to remain in school. So girls were studying more, and there's no question that that led to a drop in labor force participation. The second group that was dropping out of work the fastest, very surprising to me at least, was postgraduates. The most educated were leaving the workplace the fastest, right? These were engineers, these were doctors, and these were women who were hitting what is called the leaking pipeline. So the leaking pipeline is a very fancy, nice sounding academic term, which basically in a nutshell means that women join the workforce with great enthusiasm and a great belief that they will do well in their careers and that they will in fact have careers. Then the first bump comes when they get married. So when they get married, there's a lot of pressure, particularly in India, to A, first produce a child, and to B, to conform to the in-laws concept of what a good woman and what a good wife does. The second bump comes when she becomes a mother and she finds it very, very difficult to put in the care work as well as put in the hours in the office, right? And so if there is a woman, an elder woman at home, either a mother or a mother-in-law to help her, she might stick it out.
Care work includes activities such as cooking, cleaning, and taking care of kids, sick people, or elderly family members. It's often ignored in policy talks and goes unaccounted for.
And there was a study some years ago by NASSCOM, which actually very beautifully illustrates this conundrum. And it talks about how mid-career, they compare men and women in the tech industry. So a man will have taken more transfers. He will have taken up more challenging jobs. He will have taken up a foreign assignment, all of which a woman will not have taken up. And so she experiences a plateau in her career. And she says, I'm not getting anywhere in this job. I may as well sit at home. And then there's board exams. Then there is parents who are growing older. So all of this are very real challenges for women. And at some point, many would just give up and say, it's not worth it. I can't do this. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is that all women work. All women are not paid to work.
Shrayana tells us that there are many layers to the challenge.
I mean, let's, you know, not get away from the fact that we still live in a world where marriage is a death sentence, I think, to women's careers. I mean, you know, we want to pretend that that's not the case because, you know, we all get very nervous about commenting on marriage and we don't want to offend men and our brothers and our husbands and our friends. But all the data tells us that marriage and in particular caregiving just kicks women out of the workforce or makes them more precarious in the opportunities that they're able to access. And this is true, as you know, from the periodic labor force data, true for not only women with barely any education, but actually even true for women with secondary education or higher education, postgraduate degrees, who tend to be much more prevalent in the workforce. And unless we think very carefully and creatively about the care economy, I don't think we're going to solve that problem. And unless we don't assure young women that you can seek help in your caregiving roles, that there is life without marriage, that marriage doesn't need to be your full-time job. I think till we don't socialize women to believe that, I think it's going to be difficult. And there is a sense that this triple burden of being unsafe in the world outside, and this is particularly true for women in the north of the country, feeling unsafe at work, feeling like you have to manage the care role of your house exclusively, and the actual drudgery of, you know, regular job routines and office routines, which may not always be fun, right? Like, I certainly don't believe all of us have the luxury of having jobs that we absolutely love. I mean, even if we do, there are days which are tough. And I think navigating the sort of bro club of the office work environment, navigating unsafe travel or feeling unsafe, navigating the fact that you will have to be the one who has to always tell the maid what to cook and when to clean and when to come, right? That, I think, amongst our upper middle class creates this sense of drudgery and feeling, you know, the chick chick, right? That's the best way to put it. And I think there is this feeling that there's not adequate amount of leisure that these women can enjoy, even if they are from a fairly privileged setup where they can rely on care workers and nannies and cooks and so on. So sometimes on the surface, it may not look like the way I think sometimes they make it look like in movies, right? That you're sort of perfect hair and perfect outfits and everyone's looking like, you know, smoking cigarettes as a sense of how empowered we are. I think it can look far more messy than that. And our first generation English speaking, job holding middle class, you know, in the book, these are women who are, for example, hospitality workers or women who work in in-flight services, who are often the first in their families to complete an education, to have a job, many of them. For these women, jobs are adventure, and jobs can be meeting new people, can be meeting new men, can be romance, can be heartbreak, can be loneliness, can be supporting your father through a difficult health episode, could be buying a property. These are all new facets of personhood that have never been available to these women and the women in their families, which suddenly they can access, right? And I sense a tremendous amount of anxiety as well as enthusiasm emerging from all those freedoms. So jobs become freedom. And the last thing I will say, where I think it's a bit mixed in terms of what jobs mean, is our precariat, because, you know, till our labor programs and our minimum wage laws and our fundamental labor regulations don't protect some of our most precarious female workers, they're paid a pittance and they're working so tremendously hard that so many of these women would say to me, I'd much rather just marry someone who has a steady job and opt out. Their daughters won't say that, but some of the women in their 40s and 50s might, when they were working a decade ago or even now. And for them, there is a sense that they will have to work to earn, you know, they don't even have a retirement, right? You just have to work. So what that working woman looks like and what she feels like, I mean, it's so different and layered in a country as complicated and contradictory as ours. But I do think class has a very huge role to play in mediating it. What I will say is that none of the women I've ever met will exclusively just say, well, this is all just so terrific, because, you know, fact is, in a country where 82% of labor income accrues to men, to be part of that tiny minority of women who's receiving that labor income, you are a revolutionary, and being a revolutionary is bloody hard work.
Sharon says that self-employed women and women entrepreneurs also face prejudices and barriers.
Women tend to get about half of the loans, the credit that they do. That could be several explanations. Some of the explanations could be they're in widely different industries. So when you see men and women, it's very dichotomic. There's very little overlap between what men and women do. There's these traditional roles that maybe over time they will decrease, but that could explain maybe some areas that are less capital intensive, so the loan can be lower. But I also feel that there's a mentality when it comes to women entrepreneurs, and I've spoke to even some Asian bankers, and they say, well, that's enough for women. And women tend to believe. They tend to say, oh, I don't need more loan, that's enough for me. It's kind of like this mentality is, it's just enough and I'm lucky to get this loan. So this first thing is, this mentality of just enough for her has to stop. who is to judge? And it's really ingrained in the women of the entrepreneurs, because these aging bankers, they say, well, the woman told them themselves. But who told the woman? People in the household, people in the village. How does it say that the same business for men and women are similar? One is just enough loan when it's half the amount. The other one, you need more. So the first thing you need to overcome is that's one mentality, social norms. The other thing is, in terms of credit, I think given that women are much less, they form about 20% of the entrepreneurship ecosystem. And the great majority of that 20% is in a very tiny segment, really all coalesced and not able to grow. So when you look at those enterprises, when they go to other banks and formal institutions, given that bankers and financial institutions are not aware of those industries too much, women are disadvantaged because the banking agents have less insights into their enterprises.
Here too, the odds are stacked against women thriving financially. On the one hand, there are prejudices, and on the other, there are policy challenges. We need to address both social norms and structural issues simultaneously. Shrayana weighs in on the shifts we need to make with both.
I hear a lot of late of this kind of binary building between, oh, is it social norms that are creating problems for women in the economy, or is it just lack of jobs and just the economy? I mean, social norms, as economists understand it, are an interaction term that essentially overlay everything. Norms overlay everything. They overlay our current interactions, Saloni. They govern all our market behavior. So while absolutely we need opportunities, but I think, you know, the hard work, which is sadly perhaps not the work of policy, I think policy can help, but the hard work of families changing their minds, and I think that's happening. It's happening for sure. Of popular culture trying to support women in imagining different lives for themselves, in organizing, in movements, in politics. I think all of that is going to be really important, while the technocratic work of, you know, hopefully more women and men who think differently about distributing opportunities starts to change in our system. I think what I'm trying to push against is this binary making. I don't think it's one versus the other. I think it is an interaction. It is both. You don't have to keep waiting for norms to change to get more jobs for women and to do affirmative action for women. But at the same time, if we just keep focusing on the technocratic questions, we can't let men and unfair families off the hook either. And we can't sort of make it seem like our society is terrific when it comes to women and norms. So we have to acknowledge both with clear eyes.
Namita thinks that while there have been small wins, we still have a long way to go.
If you remember, when there was a complete lockdown and your household help was not able to come, men did pitch in. And Professor Ashwini Deshpande, who has a wealth of work, documented actually how men had stepped up. Men were helping. You know, they were chopping the vegetables, they were washing the bartans, they were doing jhadu pocha, they were doing everything they could, because they realized that the wife is also working from home, they're also working from home, and there is no one to help her. Plus, there was children's homework because the children were at home, they were not going to school. So they did step up. The bad news is that as soon as everything went back to normal, the men also went back to normal. But it just tells you that it's not rocket science, that if men want to, they can. It's a question of a change of attitude. Political parties at least are now paying lip service. So you suddenly have announcements. Every government is now tripping over each other, announcing monthly allowances for women or various schemes. Earlier, it didn't exist. But today, everybody is talking of unpaid care work, even if we're not actually doing things. Free transport for women has proved to be such a great game changer. Earlier, they would walk. The woman who's working in homes, in households, you know, cleaning bartans, has already spent 4 hours working at her own house and must go back and spend another 4 hours working again in her own house in the evening, getting the dinner and doing everything that she did in the morning again. So earlier she would walk to work, or she would accept a job only very close to her house because she didn't have the time or the money to spend 20 rupees a day on commuting and 1 hour, you know. So the time, of course, is still the same, but at least now she doesn't have to spend that 20 rupees.
We need more such initiatives. However, The woman's point of view is missing in policymaking, Shayana says.
We just have such masculine decision-making systems when it comes to the economy. And, you know, I'll use my own example. I keep, you know, using this example and beating it to death, but it's important. As one of the most privileged people in our country, even I pay a higher rental premium to live in a neighborhood that is safe and that is accommodating for single women to live on their own, right? And you can just imagine looking at the stories one hears of domestic workers, factory workers, that safe housing still remains a big issue. Now, I would argue there are several things we can do to address the housing crisis for women, particularly single women. You can think of tax incentives for landlords. You can think about subsidies for women. You can think about vouchers or housing vouchers targeted to women. The solutions are actually fairly low-hanging fruit and fairly obvious, Saloni. I mean, many countries have done these things. And many states are also trying to experiment with this. But the problem is, when we talk about the economy and jobs, we have a bunch of men who have the same cognitive map, and sadly, some women who have inhabited that same cognitive map, which seems to think that work is only, you know, this growth rate. It's essentially factories. It's essentially formalization. And, you know, we can argue about that. But, you know, questions about gendering the housing market somehow falls through the cracks, right? It's not a priority. I mean, if you just look at states and, you know, in my job, I interact with finance secretaries of many states. Most finance secretaries are men. There's a very gendered way in which problems and policy areas are divided. So to me, I think the problem is it's not just creating more opportunities. Sure, creating more opportunities for women. But the question is, who will do that? Who will take on the political will, right? And the message around that? Who will be accountable for that? And I think for that, we have to feminize those decision-making systems. We need many more women, not just in corporate boards, but in our decision-making authorities, in labor departments, in finance departments, in thinking about firm growth as well, thinking about jobs and jobs policies.
Sharon shares a few ideas for tweaks in policy that can support self-employed women.
When we look at things that are perceived as gender gaps, and that's unfortunate, like sometimes we're actually trying to look at, accepting rates of loans for women compared to men. It is sort of related to gender, but it's sort of not. I think it's related to the fact that there are less women who are prepared to apply for a business plan just out of sheer low numbers. They lack role models. They don't have access to the same networks. So the outcome seems like a gender bias. But I think what can be done is sort of like look to that pathway and what are the low-hanging fruits that can really help women, like this extra support to help business planning. See, the documents might be differently filled in and the agent banker should select, no, the documents are not complete. Things like that, I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruits. This gender divide, it could be lack of devices. It could be lack of opportunity to use a lot of the internet services. So I think things need to be tailored and understood at that level. So we tend to have put a lot on women in terms of social welfare. The government have given money to women because they will invest in their family and education, and any money they have, they've been seen as the nurturer of their family. But that comes at a cost. They don't accumulate wealth. And that also puts them at a loss when they want to get a loan. Because men, on the other side, they invest, it's okay. They accumulate their money. They have a pot of money. They have assets. They have investment. Women do not. So given that, we put this double burden on women? And then after we tell them, sorry, you don't have assets and you don't have any wealth, well, you know, that's a little bit of a ridiculous situation to be. So I think we need to think better, especially from the financial system perspective. I hear stories that, women don't like to take risk, or they're not risk takers. Why should we give them more? I think, you know, maybe we could look better, deeper in the rationale, the reason, and what you're offering to them, no? And to see why they're not taking up some opportunities that people designed for them. And sometimes it's just taking a step back and taking the opportunity to say, hey, let's think through this a little bit better. It's easier to do it now than in 20 years to say, hey, we forgot women.
This is true. It is better to step back and reconsider what we need to do now than realize later that we blundered. But how do most women themselves think about work? Based on the experiences of numerous women Shrayana met for her book, she shares some of her insights.
To be honest, 15 years I've been talking to, you know, different sets of women, particularly mother-daughter pairs. And the one thing I have actually seen is this shift from where the mother would think of work as a job, right? I just need to earn an additional income. And if you talk to their daughters, for them, work is, of course, it's income, but it's income that means something very different. It means freedom. It means a sense of personhood. It means being able to invest and cultivate a personality and their sense of taste when it comes to what they wear, what they like watching, you know, the things they want to do with their bodies and their minds. And I think the other thing that seems to have really happened is increasingly, you know, cross-caste everywhere that I've been. I only see women who are interested in trying to make care work much more open and less onerous for themselves. And they're refusing to be just locked into, you know, this routine of just cooking, cleaning, childcare and elderly care. I think they want more of life and they want men in their lives who will share in that burden. And I think that's a really important shift. And I think what remains with me is this idea that I think all these women are waging their own personal independence struggles. And some are successful, some are not. But I think this is a large struggle that's going on in almost every home. And more power to it.
Namita says it is imperative for this battle to wage on, especially now. And we leave you with her words of caution.
In fact, we're not just not where it needs to be. We need to be very careful about a slide back. If you look at what is happening in America and the rollback on abortion rights, if you look at the rise of right-wing governments everywhere, whether in South America, whether in Italy, all over the world, I mean, it is worrying and tells us that we cannot afford complacency. We cannot afford to assume that it's always a straight road ahead. In fact, it often is where women's rights are concerned. It often is two steps forward and one backward.
This episode of On the Contrary by IDR was produced by Saloni Meghani, Smarinita Shetty, Sneha Philip, and me, Shreya Adhikari, with additional support from Halima Ansari, production by Made in India. If you like our show, please subscribe and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts from, so more people can find out about us. You can also email us on writetous@idronline.org or find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Thank you for listening and see you next week.